Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions and the law. My name is Matthew Kerbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interviewed Kim Felton. Kim is an enterprising attorney, founder of Onward Immigration and Innovation Litigation, and actually was the person who introduced me to what used to be AfterPattern, so I could thank her for my previous guest, Toma Officer. While she is the second Kim I've interviewed on the show, she is the first attorney I've met who is using the subscription model to serve immigration clients. The sponsor of this podcast is 650, a business and employment legal document automation tool. When you're not billing by the hour, efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. You can get 10% off when you use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at checkout in their document marketplace. For a 650 subscription, tell them that Law Subscribed sent you to get a 10% discount on your annual subscription. For me to make a personal introduction between you and 650, click the link in the show notes called Get Connected with 650 and enter your contact information. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. Kim, thank you so much for joining me on Law Subscribed. Just to quickly tell my audience how we met, I heard you on a podcast because you've been making the rounds because you're doing some very cool things. And as I started to launch Law Subscribed in stealth mode on Twitter, there must have been something that made you want to follow me back and reach out. In part, I think because you're such a go-getter and so innovative when it comes to, you know, the legal profession, and the name of the podcast kind of speaks for itself. But then having heard you already be interviewed, I knew I had to have you on the show. So thank you so much for joining me. Can you please tell my audience a little bit more about yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. So just to answer your question, what struck out to me is you followed me on Twitter and I saw the name. And I was like, gee, I wonder who this is. I love connecting with people who are forward thinking and going into this area of law. So that's when I reached out and I said, I want to know who's behind this. My name is Kim Felton.
You've never heard of me.
But it's great. Here we are, you know, now I've heard of you. Now we've been speaking and it's been great. So my name is Kim Felton. I am an immigration attorney. I inadvertently fell into legal tech because of some personal experiences that I had. And I decided to run a virtual law firm, which is how I ended up on the legal tech road, because they kind of go hand in hand. And I didn't even think about it that way. Before I knew it, trying to figure out how to efficiently run a practice, I was learning about the tools needed to run the practice and the things that will and won't work, like the billable hour, and wanting to have a good work-life balance so that I can spend time with my kids was essential to me. And being able to dictate my own schedule was essential to me. Being able to take the clients I want to take was essential to me. So then I started to learn about subscription models. And I went to the ABA Tech Show in March 2021. And it put me on the road, fast track to dive right into this.
So I'm curious, was there anything specifically at the tech show that was on subscriptions, or was that more of you went in with that mentality and saw, here are the tools that I could use to help launch a subscription model?
Sure. So at the time, business was really slow because of COVID. And I think that I was receiving unemployment because things were just dead. And so I wanted to go to the tech show, one, because I wanted to be able to learn how to expand my horizons, and two, because I have an interest in this. And so I scraped together some money and I paid for it and I went. And I'm so glad I did, because the content was just fantastic. And there was a couple of sessions about subscription models, but it was also, it was a whole environment promoting the tools necessary and then how you can use them and how very few lawyers are using them. So it gives you an edge in the market. And it's really client focused. And so that's also something that is important to me, is being able to operate on the terms of the client. And, you know, I mean, I was disillusioned with a lot of the way that I've seen practices run prior to going on this journey myself. And so learning about how I can also change that in a way that makes the client happy. It just inspired me.
So before we even get into the subscription model, let's talk about your practice area and why you chose that area. Go ahead.
Sure. So I fell into immigration completely accidentally. I was ending my first year of law school. I had just found out I was pregnant with my first son, and I was beginning an internship with the district attorney's office, which is what I've always wanted to do. That's why I went to law school. And then I found out it was not a good fit for me, and I did not know what I was going to do, because at that point, you know, you have to make some decisions. Am I going to keep going on this track? Because this is pretty expensive. I'm having a baby. You know, I need to know what I'm going to do with this degree. Do I actually hate practicing law, or do I just not like this area? And so I spoke with a mentor who told me about a local nonprofit that would be a great fit for me. And he told me that there was two ways to get there. It was through clinics. One of them was domestic violence. The other was immigration. Now, this was August of 2016. So this is before the Trump administration and before lots of massive changes came through. And I thought to myself, oh, immigration sounds happy, not knowing anything about it. But I reached out to the clinic professor thinking I would go in the spring, and it was kismet. There was a spot that had just opened up because somebody had dropped. She said it was mine. 3 weeks later, I was sworn in with my hand on my growing belly and right in the appellate courtroom for the third department at New York. So from then on, it was love at first sight.
Excellent. And then something changed, something happened, and it might be work-life balance related. And it spurred a decision that you had to make. Tell the audience a little bit more about what happened next.
So there's a couple of things that changed. I tend to bite off more than I can chew. Well, I used to. And I always thought of myself as I can carry the weight of the world. And that's that. So I decided I was going to take the bar exam early while still in school, while raising a one-year-old. And I did a program called the Pro Bono Scholars. So there was 12 of us who were taking the bar while the rest of my class was still, you know, taking classes and not even thinking about bar prep yet. I did not pass by mere points, and it was very disappointing. And so I was getting bigger and bigger by the day, and I didn't have a job lined up. And obviously, when you're walking into interviews, despite everything being promising on the phone call, they like your resume, their eyes fall down to your pregnant stomach, and then suddenly they're going in a different direction. I did find a position when I was 30 weeks pregnant, and things seemed to be looking up and they were promising. But then that turned into a very negative experience. As soon as I came back from having the baby, it was like I was set up to fail. And I was being told that I had to put my kids to bed and drive 45 minutes back to the office because just working at my kitchen table was not good enough, or, you know, being shamed for having to leave before 5:30 because my kids, you know, I want to switch daycare pickup with my husband. He was carrying all of that, and it's just not fair. And I felt so much pressure to try and live this lifestyle that I didn't like and that I didn't want because I was worried how it would damage my career. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I was fired 4 weeks after returning from having a baby. And I think it was designed that way. Personally, they had been advertising for someone to come into the position already when I came back. I didn't know that. And the conditions were getting harder and harder to tolerate. So then one Friday afternoon, I was swiftly dismissed, and, you know, I had to figure something out. And I didn't take the bar because I had just had a baby, and that was the agreement. I was going to take it that summer. That changed everything. So I started doing contract work for other immigration attorneys. And that was where this all started to come together in terms of how I can use work as a platform to launch a virtual practice, because I had already planned to, just waiting on the bar.
So, and, you know, things, you know, haven't, you know, improved, and it's all, well, the situation you went through was terrible and shouldn't have happened in the first place. You know, you wouldn't be where you are now, and which is in a really interesting spot as one of the first attorneys that I've, you know,
discovered, who is looking at the subscription model as an innovative way to practice law and get away from the billable hour, which, you know, could allow for things like more work-life balance, could allow for hopefully, you know, better mental health of attorneys that don't have to be stressing about, you know, billable hour this, billable hour that. And so you launch this virtual practice. And did you start with subscription, or how did you start? And when did you eventually start looking at the subscription model as a potential to the virtual practice?
Sure. So there is one thing I should add. The reason why the billable hour does not work for me well is I have ADHD, and I did not get diagnosed until right before I lost that job. So all this time I had been struggling, and keeping track of my time was a nightmare for me because you forget a lot of things. And there's something called time blindness. So you don't even realize how long it's taking you to do something, because the concept of 10 to 15 minutes, it doesn't match up what it actually is. So when I learned that I could charge flat fees, I was like, oh my God, I can escape this horrid practice of incremental billing. So I, you know, it was just at the time, it was just looking at flat fees because that was a primary amount of, let me restart that. That was a majority of what a lot of practitioners were doing that I was talking with. But it was actually on my mind about the subscription billing because I had noticed a few services that do that for immigration, but they're not law firms. It's when I went to Tech Show that I saw that it was working for other practice areas. And I started wondering how it could work for immigration, because there's been a lot of talk amongst the practitioners in the community that this can't work for immigration, that there's ethical issues. There's issues with, you know, representation becoming an issue with the court. But I think it's not being looked at in the totality of the circumstances, because I see people asking about it in the groups, but just not sure how to pursue it. So it's something I slowly am rolling out to, you know, I'm doing it with a little bit of certain type of cases at a time. And I expand upon the package, so to speak, so that I can see how it works for each one, look at the metrics, and then go from there.
Let's talk about the ethical side of things, because that is a concern. And I have had, I'm not quite sure the order that this first set of interviews are going to be published, but I have had someone on the show who either my listeners have already listened to, or they will listen to after hearing this, that one of the things she does is she offers her services to lawyers on a subscription basis, and she looks at ethical concerns. And she talked a little bit about, at least for Colorado, what is required of, say, the retainer agreement when offering your services on a subscription model. So, you know, you're in a different jurisdiction, you know, in your experience, you know, what if, and this is, of course, you know, mostly the lawyers are listening and they know better, but there's no legal advice offered on this podcast, right? Just legal information. But what has been, you know, some of what you've learned about the ethical constraints and considerations when launching a subscription model?
Fortunately, where I'm barred in Minnesota, they are very open to the idea. They've even put up a mock representation agreement in the Bar Association website. So they're very welcoming to the idea and they're promoting it. And the same thing with the American Bar Association. It's really good. It's great to see that these organizations are getting behind it. But as you said, jurisdictionally, it changes. I mean, even with New York, you couldn't practice under a trade name up until last June, which is crazy to me because, you know, there's nothing exciting about the law office of Kim Felton or Felton Law. It doesn't distinguish you and it doesn't tell the public anything about what you do. So I looked into the ethics in multiple states because I wanted to know about the ethics behind the virtual practice, because I'm doing immigration, which is nationwide. So my clients are coming from all over the place and I'm bound by their state ethics rules as well as mine. You know, I'm barred in Minnesota. I'm living in New York right now. And then I can have a client from, you know, Florida, and I have to make sure that I'm following three different states' rules. It really seems to come down to that you have to make it very clear with the client what the relationship is and what it is not, because a lot of it seems to be based upon what the client's reasonable belief is as to what your relationship was. So if they truly believe that you're representing them and doing this, but you're not, that's when it can start to get murky. So in that, I make sure in the representation agreement, it's very clear that, you know, I will look over the forms. I do not send the forms. I do not sign the forms. I do not write on the forms. I send you feedback for the forms. You're the one that has to choose to implement that or not. I can advise you that I don't think it's wise to do this because X, Y, and Z, but I can't ultimately tell you, don't do this. That's your choice, but I will let you know what the implications could be. It's I'm very conscientious about spelling it out and making sure it's understandable.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. And one of the things I'm going to try to do with Law Subscribed is, you know, without, you know, it's sort of like what you say, without telling attorneys what to do, is, you know, try to give examples of exactly what you're talking about, you know, being as clear as possible in the retainer agreement, or, you know, whatever agreement, you know, that you have with your client on the subscription basis, that they understand what they're getting for the fee. Because one of the things about the subscription model that could potentially be appealing to everyday people or people who otherwise couldn't afford to hire an attorney in the billable hour is its affordability. I think that's true of businesses that hire attorneys in the subscription model, where they may save some money if they paid an attorney by the hour, but it's even more true of everyday people. And so affordability is an aspect of at least the subscription model as I see it. And so setting the price too, tell me, do you think that that's also an important factor in helping the client understand, okay, you know, if I'm only paying X amount a month, you know, I'm not expecting to receive, you know, X, Y, and Z types of legal advice or legal services, because it's only, you know, it's on prices that compete with what I'm paying for Netflix, or it's prices, you know, that compete with what I'm paying for other subscription services. Does that play a factor in deciding how much you charge per month to your clients?
So one of the biggest complaints I see amongst clients is that the lawyer doesn't communicate with them, or that they paid all of this money and they don't feel they're getting their money's worth. But I seem to find a lot, the client's expectations far exceed what a reasonable fee is. We're also competing with non-lawyer notarios that are doing these things for, you know, scalping prices. And they, you know, then they come to us and they're like, well, why are you charging so much to fill out forms? And so when you're making them understand not just the value of what you're doing for them, but everything that you're bringing to it, like your experience, you have to think about, it's not just the amount of hours or minutes or anything that you're putting into just doing these forms. It's making sure you understand that this is the form that needs to be filled out, or letting them know what an interview process is going to be like. And so for subscription models, I think having different packages to choose from, so that if a client just needs some, you know, written feedback, fills out the form, I look it over, write some feedback, send it back. Or if they want something like, they want to meet with me on Zoom, if they have questions and they want to be able to talk to me about this because they're confused, you know, being able to offer a range is good to make it more accessible too. It's funny that you mentioned Netflix, because I keep calling myself the Netflix of the immigration world. And I don't know if I can trademark that, but it's just, it helps make clients understand what it is I'm doing, and it puts it in perspective for them.
Right. Because we're all familiar with the subscription model in some other aspect of life, but in law, it's still such a novel thing. So being able to say, you know, the Netflix of this or the Amazon Prime of that. Well, first of all, you know, these companies are getting free promo, first of all, so they shouldn't be too upset. I don't think you could trademark it. I'm not an IP lawyer, but I think that does help, you know, help prospective clients understand, you know, what you do. But I do want to dive into like the types of different packages that you offer and how you sort of reach that conclusion. And I think part of that discussion has to be, you know, how do you price those things? So is it just the subscription? I know you already said you do flat fee. So do you do flat fee plus subscription, some sort of combination? How do you, like, when you're putting together these packages, how are you thinking about pricing them? And then I want to get into the actual packages and what's offered and how you choose.
So, you know, it can be difficult to figure that out, because in trying to figure out what a client needs, I went and I surveyed people in a self-help immigration group to figure out Okay. Why didn't you hire a lawyer for this process? What was it that you didn't like? What was it that you liked? What was it that they didn't have that you wish they had? What are you looking for to be able to take your stress and hand it over to an attorney? Now, at the time, I'm thinking about full representation. And then somebody said something along the lines of, I had these forms filled out and I booked a paid consultation and I met with this attorney and he wouldn't look at them. He said it was all or nothing. He had to do the whole package or he wouldn't touch it. Attorneys are risk averse. So naturally, they're not going to want to look over and comment on somebody else's work. However, I don't think it has to be an absolute. So I started thinking about packages in terms of the types of forms that people struggle with and the types of questions that we usually get. And it, you know, the basic package, it only includes certain forms because other forms, like for asylum or Violence Against Women Act for abuse victims, those are complicated. And it's not as simple as doing an I-130 to petition for an alien relative. So it takes longer, it takes more expertise. So dividing it up that way is helpful and making sure that each package, there's the terms and conditions and what is and isn't included. They have to acknowledge it 3 times before they book the package. So I'm still primarily flat fees because I'm rolling this out slowly to see how what kind of response I get. I guess I want to say it's almost like I'm in the beta process. But being able to do add-ons. So these cases are taking a long time to process. So it could even work for full representation. You could do monthly fees for a consular process case that takes 24 months right now, because the clients are going to ask you every month, what's going on with my case? What's going on with my case? How come we haven't heard anything? And you do spend time getting back to them, explaining to them, even if you're explaining the same thing over and over. You know, it's an anxiety issue. It's their life on the line and they want to know. And I think they feel better just by reaching out, feeling like they're doing something proactive. And so attorneys might be less bitter about it, about having to answer the same questions over and over if it was built into the fee. And so you have to think about for each case, how much time am I spending doing this task? How can I bill it out so that I'm not getting a whole ton of money up front that I'm going to end up having to give back? Or how can I do this so that a client that wouldn't normally sign with me sees this as an attractive option and then it works for both of us?
So you mentioned something there that might have that perked up my ears and might perk up some others. And you said you still have to track your time, but you don't mean like in the billable hour way. You just have to be conscious of the time you're spending so that you can properly price or adjust or change the subscription or flat fee down the road. Is that's what you mean, right?
Systems are so important. Systems and automation. I mean, that's a whole nother podcast that I did, but that's what it comes down to is the efficiency of the process. Because if you tighten it up really well, you're not going to be spending an enormous amount of time on it. You might at first, because if you're learning something, but you're not going to be dreading it or thinking about it in terms of like, oh, well, did I spend an hour on this or 15 minutes on this? No, it's I shot out this email. I reviewed this form. I typed this up. It seemed to wrap up within an hour. You know, it's a guesstimate. It's being aware of your pace and your environmental factors. Because, like I said, I have ADHD. It doesn't take much to distract me, especially if my kids are home. It's a nightmare to try to work with my kids at home because noises or, you know, yelling, hitting, fighting, whatever they do as little boys. It will draw my attention away. And then I'm sitting down and standing up and starting the same process over and over again, but not getting any further. But once I have a system, it makes it a lot easier to see where I left off. I can automate things so that I don't have to do those over and over. And being able to document it so that I can pass it along to staff down the road is it's really how I think a model like this could thrive.
Yeah, and I mean, just to take a brief aside as a brother with a younger brother, I would just like to apologize on behalf of all brothers who fight to their mothers and to their parents. I know it doesn't make up for it, but we apologize on behalf of all brothers.
Oh, well, it's appreciated. But you
Yeah.
know, my oldest is a great big brother. He's going to be 5. My youngest is going to be 3. They're 23 months apart. So, you know, they're at that age. And I have a younger sister. We were 7 years apart though, so it was different. Yeah. And I know that we wrestled, but it was nothing like my boys do. They'll go hug each other and they'll end up just rolling around on the floor at that point.
Well, you know, kids, they're still manipulative and they don't want their parents to really be mad at them. So they'll find a way to make it up at the end.
Yeah, I got my money's worth with my son. He definitely paid attention when he was in utero.
Yeah. Yeah. Two of you went to law school. Yeah.
When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney, or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form at scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
So back to the packages though, like how do you decide, you know, what's worth more, right? And like, you know, how do you actually get the clients to limit it? So if, you know, they're only paying for the looking over the forms package tier, you know, you're calling it packages. Some other attorneys will call it different tiered levels, you know, cause you're paying mm-hmm. more based on the more stuff that you're getting, you know, to cut off, you know, the Zoom option for one, but then if they're paying a little more, they get the Zoom.
Yep.
You know, how do you come to that decision and how do you enforce it with your clients? And then of course, you give them the option to, hey, you know, we could hop on a Zoom, but it's only, you know, X amount more per month or whatever it is.
It's an add-on. It's, you know, it's a la carte. So if they want to have the access to that Zoom, they just do the add-on. It can be a 30-minute call for, you know, $25 or, you know, something along those lines. That's just a general guesstimate. When it comes to figuring out what goes into the packages, you have to think about it in a way that it makes sense. So you're going to have the base package. They're still going to get what they need out of it. But if they don't want the extras, like if they don't want to talk to me on a call, if they don't think that's necessary, if they just want to know how their forms look, that's a good option. It's affordable. It's super, super affordable. And then you bring it, you go up from there and showing the difference between each package. You know, I haven't, like I said, this is still in the beta phase. So I'm still really trying to get this out there, and because clients have not heard of this. So trying to make sure it's known, people will come to me and automatically assume it's all or nothing. And then I'm trying to get the word out, like, no, things are changing. You know, I'm going into my second year now. I just ended the first year of practice and I really want to shift towards this model where, yes, of course I'll give you full representation, but this is really where you can find the bread and butter of the practice.
And something that we talked about on our pre-show conversation is, you know, I believe you called this monetizing clients you normally wouldn't bring in. Right.
Yeah. Yep.
And so what was it that led you to that conclusion? And something else you talked about was looking for areas of serious need in between limited scope and full representation, which is also something that's a unique thing I've heard, you know, doing this project that I'd like you to talk a little bit more about.
Sure. I mean, that all kind of sparked from thinking about a virtual practice, because it used to be where I didn't even think about I could have my law office on the laptop. And then it was after I graduated law school and I had heard that up north in New York, I mean, like way north, we're talking like Dannemora between Albany and the Canadian border. The problem is there's not a lot of immigration attorneys out in that area. And then, you know, there's still Western New York. There's a whole bunch of rural areas. You've got general practitioners and these general practitioners are older. And that is dying out. Everybody I know coming out of law school is starting to go into a niche subject, or at least focused on one area. And I don't think that anybody who does immigration should just do general practice, because it's far too complex. So thinking about, wow, there are these people near the Canadian border that don't have representation, that the border just as much as the US-Mexico border is. And how do they get access to that? It's not like they can drive. Some of them don't even have a license or a car. And so that's when I started thinking about the virtual practice model, because thinking about the access to justice issue there, that's going to really start to come to crisis levels within the next decade. It alarmed me. And so that was kind of the basis for launching a virtual practice. And then even further with the subscription model, there's these clients that, you know, nobody is planning to get detained by ICE. Nobody is planning for their other lawyer to screw up and then it results in them in removal proceedings. So how do we fix that? And then they've already paid X amount to this lawyer that messed up. They don't have much more to give, but I still have expertise I'm bringing. So I still need to be able to benefit from the process. So then I started thinking about different ways to do that, like coaching clients to be their own advocate, teaching them about that specific part of the process. What can they expect in their asylum trial? You know, just smaller things that they can break down that will help them, and they don't have to go all or nothing.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, and I know it's a whole podcast in and of itself on the technology side of things, but I'll try to link to it in the show notes. Kim's been on a bunch of other podcasts talking about it, so I encourage my listeners to go there to get more of a deep dive. But just touch in a little bit about the technology that you're using for your virtual practice that you maybe plan on using and adapting to this subscription model as it continues in beta and leaves beta. Tell us a little bit more about some of that.
So those programs are what pretty much made it, you know, they're essential for me, because it's not just about a subscription model, but it's also about self-help. So I use Afterpattern, and I've started building out a lot of different things on there. One of them was a comprehensive, it's almost an intake pretty much, and it's questions for all different kinds of information that you collect, and it screens for multiple areas of eligible relief for immigrants. So it could be if you're the spouse of a military member, if you might have derived citizenship from your parents, if you have been the victim of a crime, if you might have been trafficked. And the questions are asked in ways that make sense. And so they go through and they'll answer them. And then at the end, instead of a 13-page PDF that we would have had to sit and fill out with them, it gives me one page with checks on it. And it shows the areas where they may be eligible for relief. It shows me areas where they might have issues, if they need a waiver, if there's a permanent bar, if there's, you know, other situations that are going to crop up, and then if they might be eligible for a waiver. And then you review that, and then it gives them an idea of what we're looking at. Because that's a lot of the questions that come in is, well, how do I get a green card? Well, there's different ways to get there. And then after that, when everything started happening with Afghanistan, I kept thinking about how hard putting together a humanitarian relief package could be for somebody, especially somebody that doesn't know the law, may not speak English. And I built I call it a case pack, where you fill in the information, it'll put in the beneficiary information, which is the person that needs humanitarian parole. Then there's the sponsor, and it's all in a database that talks, you know, to each other, and it fills out the forms for you, and it puts together a cover letter for you, it puts together a checklist for you, and it gives you instructions on what you need to do and what will happen after you file this. So it was like, I put it together so rapidly that first edition, it's not as great, but you know, it never is. The MVP, I suppose. I'm just about finished with the polished one now. And I'm hoping to be able to offer the ability where after they sign it and scan it, it can be mailed off for them without them having to go to a post office or even think about it.
Yeah. And for those of you who are listening and you're not quite sure what MVP means, it does not mean most valuable player. It means minimum viable product. Kudos to you, Kim, on knowing the tech and startup lingo. And that's something that I think that's actually, you know, pretty courageous, that not a lot of lawyers aren't willing to put out an MVP because it has to be perfect. But the reality is it doesn't have to be. And these people are not going to get the help that they got with the MVP that you put out. They're not going to get any help, you know, even close to that. And you'll improve on it as you go. And I think that, you know, your willingness to do that, you know, is really important. And other attorneys could look to that and learn from that. And then with programs and, you know, like After Pattern, you don't need to reinvent the wheel every time. You don't need to start from scratch every time. And you know, and since you're not billing by the hour, you're not incentivized to, right? So you could just put that together. You don't have to make that form, you know, again. You know, you don't have to sit there and go through everything with them. The client fills it out and then you can improve upon it. And then that improves upon it for all future clients that will fill out whatever you're putting together on After Pattern, right?
Yeah. So what's great is I finally started working with the databases. And so what's great with this is that with the second one that I've built, the second version, it makes it so they don't have to keep inputting the same information over and over, which is why I created databases for the person that needs humanitarian parole. If there's a sponsor, I mean, there's different scenarios where there's somebody else preparing the petition. There's an interpreter. There is somebody who is a co-sponsor, or the person that needs humanitarian parole is sponsoring themselves. So that can get really confusing. And right behind my laptop is actually sticky notes on a wall and a diagram that I put together to try to figure it out, because I have spent a lot of time on this polished product. And some of it was hyper-focus. I got just drawn right in and figuring out what I could do. But what's great about it is it's made me think about other ways to do this with other cases. And so being able to offer that if they want to pay for a monthly fee to do these forms and these products and get access to resources and different things through a client portal to be able to do the case themselves for work that I've already done. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe there are some attorneys out there who they want to do this kind of thing, but maybe they have more difficulty learning about, you know, how to use After Pattern and that kind of thing. Is that something that, you know, you're out there help, you know, you're able to, you know, attorneys can come find you to help them set those kind of things up?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, After Pattern was what introduced me to coding. So I'm starting to learn that, you know, very basic, but I really like seeing how you can take this unreadable sheet of formulas and functions and then make something out of it. And so After Pattern's what introduced me. So absolutely, I'm more than happy to help. But I also think that with systems like After Pattern, it empowers other people to learn themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think coding is going to be something that a lot of lawyers are going to need to know as we go forward, because we're in a digital age. And so it's kind of hard to expand your practice area if you're just restricted to the main products, like, you know, a practice management system, email. There's so much more that you can do, like connect them all with Zapier. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's got coding involved in it. So I think my point of this is don't be as intimidated, just kind of dive in and play around too. You're not hurting anything.
Yeah. And, you know, as a fellow, you know, tech forward attorney, I really appreciate your comment on the sticky notes, because sometimes just having a good whiteboard session or some sticky notes, it still is a good way to help organize thoughts that while I love using technology and even digital, you know, whiteboards, it's just, there's still something about that tactile, you know, learning process and figuring and sorting things out that really helps. So we're not saying abandon all, you know, tactile type planning, but it's time to, you know, to learn a little bit about coding, maybe not become a full-fledged coder or some low code, you know, tools. And it's a lot of it's if this, then that logical flow that attorneys should,
absolutely,
you know, they should be able to figure out, even just to converse with somebody like you or someone else who could help them, you know, dive deeper. I agree. It's definitely worth, you know, learning a little bit more. So as we sort of get towards the end, I just have a few more questions for you. Sure. And one of them is, and I'm not sure we didn't, you know, really talk about this before the show, but I'm curious, you know, your thoughts on it, if you have any. And that is, when you are more deep into the subscription model, how do you keep people subscribed? So certainly, you know, they have a case, so they have more form, but when that's over, or even during that process, you know, have you thought about any incentives or any reason why clients will stay subscribed even after they've gotten their, you know, well, you know, maybe what they initially came for. Like, for example, I really want to watch The Mandalorian, so I'm only going to buy, you know, Disney Plus for 1 month. I'm just going to binge The Mandalorian in a month, and then I'm going to unsubscribe. So how do you avoid that kind of thing with the subscription model as you've been maybe thinking about this more and more?
I hope they're like me and forget that they subscribe to something. I'm just kidding.
Well, hold on. You joke, but the thing is, it is a little bit like the gym membership in a way, in that you subscribe to go to the gym, and the gym can possibly fit everyone who is paying, you know, that monthly fee if they were to all show up at the same time. But the equipment is there and the space is there when you want to go to the gym and use it, right?
This goes back to the ethical side of things too, because, you know, there's some people that argue, well, you're getting paid, but you're not doing the work you're getting paid for. Well, no, getting paid to make myself available, to make my expertise available, to make my resources available. It's up to them whether or not they want to use them. So, I mean, in terms of incentivizing it, I just was saying to my husband, you know, with the pandemic, Peloton's business model was brilliant. Sell them the equipment and then keep them paying to use the equipment. I was like, oh my God, like, I mean, I know that we do that, but just seeing it on a bike is crazy to me. So I don't expect people to say subscribe beyond what they need that for in their process, but I do think they'll come back because immigration is a multi-step process. You know, if they want to stay subscribed in the meantime and start getting things ready for the next part of their process or learn about it, great. But, you know, I welcome them to come back too. If they're ready to pause it, you know, come back and see what's going on. You know, I'm happy to speak with them about what the different benefits are of keeping the account versus deleting, because if you delete, then it's all gone. You know, there's nothing to be done about that. But if you keep it, then you have access to the information you've already input. So it's still a work in progress. I'm thinking about that because I want to get a few people involved and then measure metrics from there and figure out troubleshooting and figuring out, well, how could I make this better? Or they wanted to fill out the form, and then as soon as they were done with that, they canceled. What can I do to keep them around until the decision? What if they get an RFE? What if they have to appeal? You know, offering stuff like that, because those are services that, you know, attorneys usually are needed for. But I like the idea that if it's too complex, they'll get a discount on moving over to full representation.
Right. So the opportunity for a discount is a potential thing. And before I lose out on, before we get too far away from it, and bear with me, audience, because I am a relatively new dad, though dad jokes are not something that are new to me, but now I actually can like make these jokes. So, and I don't know if we could patent this one either, but Peloton model, the Peloton model, right? Of subscriptions. So
called it.
There you go. There you go. And for those of you that are more visual, I'll spell this out in the show notes too, so you can see the correct spelling of this pun. But thinking about it like that is really important. Is, you know, look at models out there that are successful, and, you know, how do you take what works for them and apply it to, you know, your business? And in a services based business, yeah, it's different. But then that also makes me wonder, and I've never thought about this until just now, is there a physical product or something that you can provide your clients as part of your service? You know, we all talk about everything going digital and having these, you know, digital platforms that your clients can sign into, but is there a physical aspect of that that maybe can be a part of your subscription? And I don't know, but I think there's an interesting, you know, you could think about maybe ways that you can put something together, whether it's a piece of technology or something that you give to your client in addition to, you know, something else when they sign up, like the Peloton model that I'm talking about. Yeah. So, but in the meantime, just offering a discount to additional services needed, as long as they may stay a subscriber, I think that is definitely what I'm talking about when I'm talking about incentivizing people to stay subscribed. And there's a lot more to talk about. And that's one of the big things that I want to unpack at Lost Subscribed. Mm-hmm. is how do you keep people subscribed? You know, how do you build incentives? So that's an excellent one. One of the last things I want to touch on with you is you wrote this article on Above the Law, A Better Way, How Motherhood Changed My Perspective of the Legal Field and What I'm Doing to Change It. And I'm going to link to it in the show notes. It's a really good article. I've had another guest on that has a similar article about her experience and how the what I call the legacy model of law just doesn't work for women and especially mothers. And then there's a question of whether or not it should. ABA data has shown, at least from 2021, data on the profession has shown that the legacy model has failed women. They failed attorneys of color. More women are going to law school than men now, but only 20% are actually in leadership positions at firms. So the legacy model doesn't work. And there's a few different ways to look at it. One is that it should work and it should be more, you know, inclusive to women and attorneys of color. And I absolutely agree with that. But on the other side is it's not working. And so what can attorneys of color do to sort of get the power back and like you've done, you know, launch a virtual, you know, law firm, look at the flat fee, look at the subscription model, look at alternative billing arrangements, not be stuck in, you know, trapped by dogma that these old law firms, these legacy law firms are. And most of the people I talk to on this show are women or attorneys of color. And so you all are the innovators in this space. Do you think that the subscription model is one of those answers to the problem of these institutional problems in the legal profession?
Absolutely, because this profession was never meant to include us. And I say that in my article, we were never meant to be included. And so the last time I pulled data was when I started doing my contract work and making a website for it, which is innovationlitigation.com. But in 2019, the statistics I looked at, it was around 70% of women exit the legal profession before they hit the 10-year mark. That is alarming. That's because of burnout. That's because of the failure to go up on the ladder. Because you said the leadership positions are what, 23%? That's 20, insane to me. So we have to force our way into this space and we need to force our way in on our terms. And I really think that subscription model, flat fees, you know, it all has its benefits, but especially with a subscription model, you get so much of your life back. And you're not focused on making a partner happy or making them money. And you're not worried about being judged if you need to go take your kid to urgent care.
Yeah. And nobody should be, you know, mother or father or whatever their situation. And in any job, let alone the legal profession, but the legal profession has been very bad when it comes to that in terms of being understanding. And a lot of that comes down to, well, you could be billing your time.
Yep. And it seems to be that it's indoctrinated into the people that accept it. So it just keeps going. You know, this could die out when, you know, some of the older generations exit the profession within the next decade or so, but it won't because other people were taught that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, and maybe, you know, the people that start these firms that are billing in an innovative way, like yourself, you know, maybe just the solo practitioner or the small firm model works for that. And that's great. And maybe they grow into the next, you know, big firm. I think for a time, there's such a blue ocean of people that are not receiving legal services and need them that it's not going to interrupt the legacy model because those people would never have hired those firms anyway. Right. But over time, I think it will be disrupted.
Yeah, we're disrupting and it's kind of like through the back door.
Yeah. And with that, I have one final question for you, Kim, and that is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
Oh, God, no.
Why?
Why not? That is the weirdest question I've ever been asked. I feel like that's something my son would ask me. Because my son eats hot dogs without buns. He'll eat them cold. That is not a sandwich.
Okay, so a single individual hot dog, but a hot dog on a bun, is that a sandwich?
You know, I actually had to do an exercise in law school and argue about whether or not a pita pocket was a sandwich. This was in my intro to lawyering class, like the very beginning of law school. So it's funny that this is brought up. I never thought about the hot dog as being a sandwich because it's marketed as its own thing. I suppose if it's sandwiched between two slices of bread with toppings, you could argue that, but when I think of a sandwich, I'm thinking of, you know, two separate slices of bread with meat, cheese, or other fixings in the middle of it.
Okay, so a hot dog in a bun, not a sandwich. But if you rip that bun in half, sandwich.
Yeah, I would say that.
Okay. All right.
I'm not going to die on that hill, though.
Kim, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. We're going to keep put all the links to all your stuff in the show notes, but where's the best place for people to reach out and to find you?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter as @legally_mommed. Same on Instagram. Those are my personal ones. Onward Immigration is my law firm. And Innovation Litigation is where I offer consulting and contract work for other immigration attorneys. My consulting goes beyond immigration. But yeah, I mean, I'm not hard to find. Just you look up my name, Kimberly Felton, KimberlyLey, and you'll find my face pop up a lot.
Great. Well, I look forward to having you back on the show when your subscription model is in full swing. So until then, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for sponsoring this show. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with someone you think would find a value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.